Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Today on GDP, the kickoff episode of Season 3, we're here with John D. Cameron. Dr. Cameron is an Associate Professor of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Canada. His research focuses on the public policy advocacy by international development and climate change organizations, indigenous self-governance in Bolivia, the ethics of global citizenship, and representations of global poverty and development by nonprofit and charitable organizations. So today we have Dr. John Cameron with us, and holy smokes, is it lovely to be here at the start of Season 3 of GDP with John Cameron. I love chatting with these great guests. I love hearing your feedback on the podcast, and I love the fact that we've made it this far, taking us up to 30 podcasts, and I love the fact that we have another 40 lined up. And there's just so much to love, and I mean, love is all you need, which is why we're talking about love and asking, what does love got to do with it? Dr. John Cameron and his latest research endeavor is about love and development, which is absolutely lovely. Professor Cameron, welcome to GDP.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
It's lovely to have you here if we're going to follow this theme around. You're looking at research on love and international development. And this is Season 3 of GDP, and we're sort of taking it back to a place that looks at new and innovative research. We want to hear about it. What does love have to do with development?
Really good question, and I'm glad you're asking. So we know from research in medicine and health, on mental health, on physical health, that love has huge impacts on human well-being. We know, and we've known this for a long time, but love, and in particular the capability or the capacity to love and to be loved, is broadly overlooked in development research and analysis of development policy. So we know it's really important on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's overlooked in development research.
In what ways? I mean, you mentioned capabilities. This takes us back to the very first podcast of the series, where we talked about the capabilities approach. What is mentioned about love in terms of capabilities?
Sure. So Martha Nussbaum, who's one of the founders and intellectual leaders of the capabilities approach to development, she devised a list of what she calls the 10 core capabilities, the 10 capabilities that all human beings need to have in order to thrive and function as really full human beings, in order to reach their human potential. And she specifically identifies love and the capability to love and be loved as one of those 10 core capabilities. Another interesting example that kind of shows that we've known about this for a long time, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is something that almost all undergraduates learn about at one point or another in a social science class or a psychology class. As long ago as 1943, Maslow identified love as one of the core human needs, right after our physical needs like food, water, shelter, and our physical safety needs, so not getting shot at or not being in a danger zone. After those two needs, he identified love as kind of next in that hierarchy. So again, we've known for a long time, or we should have known for a long time, that love is really important to human well-being.
Right.
And yet, we certainly in the development studies community haven't paid much attention to it.
Well, it's almost shocking in some feels to think about why love is studied and others why it's not. I mean, when I was working in Cuba, I was taking a group of physicians from Quebec around to look at the medical education in eastern Cuba, in the province of Las Tunas. And we were at the medical school there, and in this faculty of medicine, there is a dedicated course that residency students and students themselves have to take, and it's a course on love.
Wow.
And it's physicians who are getting ready to practice who have this philosophical and artistic exploration of love. And I don't know in any medical curriculum in North America where that actually gets slotted in intentionally. But what I wonder about this is, why is there such a reluctance of dealing with or studying love in international development studies? Is it relegating it to the business of poets? Like, I mean, it's like I said, we might find odd that physicians are studying love, but we would expect poets to study love, the sorts who lived in Paris and suffered from tuberculosis in the 19th century, and we would expect that to be part of their portfolio. But why is it? Is it because love is emotional, or have we just ignored it?
Right. I think it's a really good question. And, despite the fact that love is very literally all around us, mm-hmm. Every second pop song on the radio, novels, poems, movies, pop culture is full of love and the exploration of love and heartache and the kind of emotions related to love. And yet within development studies, we haven't really grappled with it seriously. I think there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is the legacy of modernization theory, positivism, the emphasis on rationality.
The rationalism, that's what I was thinking of. There's such a tendency to want to be rational.
Right, that development as modernization is really all about getting beyond emotions and being rational beings where we make decisions on the basis of reason, not emotion. Mm-hmm. And there's a strong legacy of that kind of thinking in development studies that would suggest that emotions have no place here.
Right.
Within the social sciences, there's been a turn towards taking emotions more seriously, and not just love, but all emotions, that the emotional experience is a valid part of what it means to be a human being. And all areas of social science need to take emotion seriously. Love is an example of one particular emotion that I think is especially important, mm-hmm. Not just because of what we would call its emotional effects, but also the health impacts. But I think there's some other reasons why we may not have taken love seriously as well. Another is as an emotion, and an emotion that is often gendered and associated in particular with women, this is speculation, but it may be that love and emotions more broadly are not seen as serious stuff that doesn't really merit hard research. I would certainly argue that that's wrong and that love does merit hard research, but trying to understand why we haven't taken it seriously. There are also methodological challenges, like just figuring out how do you study love and people's ability to love and people's ability to feel loved. And then the final reason, I think, is that there's love is often perceived as being beyond the realm of public policy. It's a purely individual phenomenon.
The Ministry of Love.
Right. Well, I mean, our former Prime Minister, the senior Trudeau, Pierre mm-hmm. Trudeau, is famous for saying the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation.
That's right.
And we could extrapolate from that maybe the state has no place in the love of the nation. And yet, in the research I've done, it pretty clearly shows that there are a lot of ways in which governments can undermine people's capacity to love and be loved.
Oh, very much. And then at the same stroke, protect it.
Right. Right.
When you see the redefinitions of marriage and civil unions and even for relationships that go across borders, how some governments are very inclusive and very respective about that, and others are completely divisive and incredibly narrow-minded.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So this is really interesting about that emotional engagement with it. I'm just thinking back, what you're going at here, and I really like this, is that you're finding an area that is underexplored, and just by recognizing that there's that lack of attention to it is going to bring out such important questions. And I'm just thinking back to what the historian Howard Zinn wrote when he was interviewed after his writing his
long saga of the people's history of the United States, he had this quote where he said that when you look at history, if it's on development or U.S. history or whatever it is, it's very easy to look at it as these back-to-back block centuries of war and pestilence and invasion and all of these nasty things put together. But yet within those moments are these people who act quite heroically, who are the game changers, who are the ones that create impacts against the current. And often what motivates people to challenge authority is from quite deep commitments to love of humanity and for others. And this is exactly what, you know, Che Guevara said a very similar thing. What makes you a revolutionary? Love. Well, you wouldn't think that about a guy running around in the Sierra Maestra with weapons and grenades, but it was this sort of deeper connection to it that's starting to come out. And I find that, back to your original point about that sort of culture of rationalism within social sciences and development studies, what's also interesting is that there are other emotional words that we tend to employ in development studies, if not market what development studies is. And one of the biggest ones is passion, right? That people who are interested in getting involved in the subject, taking the introduction class or coming out of high school, you hear about how passionate they are. Does that create a challenge or an extension of what you're looking at in some way?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It makes me think of the work that psychologists and medical researchers have done on love. They typically distinguish between different forms of love and then the different biophysical impacts that those different forms of love have on human beings. So parent-child love is one example, romantic love, another form of love, and then what we might call cosmopolitan love or love of humanity, as well as spiritual love. And so I think when we think about that passion, it partly connects to the love for humanity or cosmopolitan love, the ability to feel emotions of love for people who you don't necessarily know, who may live far away, who may have very different beliefs from you, but that you still are able to generate some of those emotions or feelings of love towards those people, like a deep form of caring. So it's obviously very different from the kind of love that you'd have with a romantic partner or between parent and child, but many of the same kind of biophysical and mental health benefits still come from the feeling of loving other people.
And is that something that is inherently natural? I think, like, as it's mentioned in the capabilities approach, it's essential to have love to be flourishing as a human being. But just as you mentioned there, like, to have a caring relationship or to have parent-child love, these are also, they require skills. They require emotional intelligence, they require interpersonal skills, and they require adaptability as well. Is that something that is part of this picture? I mean, in terms of how scholars can approach this.
Right, absolutely. So, and those skills, the ability to love or the capacity to love other people and the capacity to receive love and feel love, I mean, the main way in which we develop those capacities is through our relationships with our parents in particular.
Right.
And one of the, I think, the most chilling examples of how those capacities have been, for many people, shut down or narrowed or shut off is the history of residential schools in Canada. During the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there were many survivors of the residential schools who talked about the ways in which their current ability to love and be loved, in some cases 30, 40, 50 years later, had been seriously damaged by their experience in the residential school, being taken away from their families, never being treated with love. And they talked about the impact that denial of love had on their own ability to love their children a generation later. And then the children of the survivors, who are also survivors, are also dealing with those legacies. So these can be multi-generational the impacts can be long-lasting and multi-generational. So children who grow up in loving families will have the benefit of that love. But the negative impacts and positive benefit impacts also are passed along to other generations.
That is really important. And in this case with residential schools, it hits on also a broader theme about that association with religion or institutionalized religion mm-hmm. and love. Because within the residential schools, a lot of what the priests, the nuns who were leading this, there was a lot of love of God, love of Jesus. Mm-hmm. It was using the same word, but in a completely mm-hmm. different context. And here, I'm wondering if the way we've been just discussing sort of the benefits of love, if there's also a dark side to it here we may be missing. In that, I'm thinking that love was a term used frequently in a lot of colonial experiences. And this, in season three, we're in Guatemala with interviewing a couple of scholars who are experts on the colonial experience in Guatemala. And a lot of that experience with the Jesuit interventions in the Americas using love of God to justify some pretty transformative actions. Is there a risk of love being used in a similar sort of coloniality?
Yeah, I think like any powerful word, love can be abused.
Yeah.
I guess I'd want to distinguish between a negative side of love mm-hmm. on the one hand, and then the abuse of the term on the other hand. So
yeah, right.
When the word or the concept of love is being misused, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a dark side. It means that there are people who recognize that the word has a lot of power, and they're using that power for, you know, bad outcomes.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
I think that's, you know, it's in many cases the use of the concept of love to justify harm is an indication of the power of the word, that actors recognize that word has power and they use it for their own purposes. I think that's a bit different from recognizing a negative side to love itself, or a potential negative side to love itself. And on that point, I guess what I just flag is that, you know, I think many of the listeners probably feel this personally. Love can drive us to do all sorts of crazy things
that are
not in our best interests a lot of the time.
Some people have described it as a disease.
And yet that, I think, also highlights the power of this emotion, that it can, you know, Maslow identified it as in a hierarchy that came after physical needs and safety needs. But in some contexts, there are lots of people, again, probably maybe you and I, many of the listeners, have put love at number one. I mean, there are times when love overrides your concerns about your own safety, about hunger, about, you know, everything else.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about the poets in Paris in the 19th century who, you know, were writing love note after love note, but yet starving and suffering from tuberculosis, right? It can drive you to that state.
Right, and certainly, you know, heartbreak, the experience of heartbreak, what that will drive people to do, you know, we could see that as a dark side. But again, what it highlights is the power of this emotion and how deeply most people crave the experience of loving and being loved. That it not in itself is a drug, but if we look at some of the biomedical research, the feeling, the perception of being loved and of loving releases all sorts of amazing biochemicals in our bodies.
Oh yeah.
So it almost is a drug in and of itself. So it's understandable why we might become addicted to it.
And the withdrawal of it is incredibly hard and crushing in that way. You know, and I think it maybe gets back to this idea where it's always assumed, or often assumed, that love is something just so inherently human that it'll just find its way into our lives. And that's not the case. And I think this is what Nussbaum's original point was, is that mm-hmm. the capabilities are this balance between you know, individual's capacity, but also protection against the vulnerabilities to make sure that these factors do flourish and flourish well. And it also leaves the opportunity for that education, that intelligence to be sort of developed over time, mm-hmm. Personally and within broader disciplines. I'm just thinking There's that one episode of The Simpsons where Homer's infatuated with his coworker Mindy, and he's in the bar with Barney Gumble, and Barney just comes up with this great thing, and he says, you know, your attraction to this woman is just based on infatuation. Talk to her. You'll find you'll have very little in common, and you'll go back to your regular life. And Homer says, Barney, that's genius. And where did you come up with that? He's like, oh, I just read it on a bar napkin, you know. But the idea that that being aware of when things are true or untrue and positive or being used in a manipulative way. I just want to go back to what we mentioned about heartbreak, something that you've written in a presentation that earlier this year, was that heartbreak may actually offer pathways towards cosmopolitan solidarity. That connection between heartbreak and cosmopolitanism. What have you referred to when you talk about that?
Right. So one of the my other areas of research is on global citizenship or cosmopolitanism, and in particular, the challenge of motivating ordinary people to think and act like cosmopolitans. So to genuinely care about the well-being of people who live far away and are very different from us, who may have beliefs that are very different from our own beliefs. And as a step before being able to care about people who are very different and who live far away, we need to be able to in some way relate to them, to imagine ourselves in their position, to feel empathy for them. One of the difficulties, at least I think I could say for many North Americans or people living in Western Europe, is in terms of our daily lives, it's often very difficult to relate to the material circumstances of people in other parts of the world. So we don't know what it's like to live their lives.
No.
The sense of poverty, perhaps the deprivation of human rights, all of those experiences are foreign. So that doesn't make empathy impossible, but it challenges empathy. Rather than focusing on trying to imagine what it's like to live in poverty or what it's like to live in parts of the world that are very different from, say, Halifax or an urban center in Canada, thinking about emotional experiences may offer another pathway towards cosmopolitan solidarity. So the universality of the drive to love, to want to be loved, to feel heartbreak, to feel anguish, those are emotions that almost all adults experience.
Mm-hmm.
And by focusing more attention on the universality of emotions like love, we may be able to identify and empathize more deeply with people who live far away, who are maybe very different from us, but we can imagine that, you know, they share the emotional experiences of heartbreak. If we imagine for parents the anguish of having a sick child and not knowing if they're going to survive, and then imagining what would it be like if you lived in a place where there was no decent medical care, and if your child got sick, their chances of dying was 50 times more than in Canada.
Right.
Or the anguish of being away from the people you love. So if we imagine the number of people around the world who emigrate, who migrate to work in other places just in order to survive economically, and that forces them to be away from their families, away from the people they love and who love them for long periods of time, that may help us to reflect more deeply and to empathize more deeply with those people.
There's a lot to be said about that. You know that when some of the work that I do, extremes are sort of my, you know, sub area of interest, and looking at these extreme divides in health and wealth, and within those are just these radically different experiences. And when we look at traditional development indicators, they're usually always focused on death, right? Or something tragic occurring. And the experience of, you know, infant mortality rates that are 200 per thousand are incredibly different than infant mortality rates in a country where they're only 3 per thousand. But by focusing on that negativity and the tragedy of it, it almost becomes impossible to share that sort of universal cosmopolitan value. But the idea of flipping that over on and looking at caring and looking at the ability to care, comfort, nurture, support, that tends to have a deeper resonance regardless of where you are in that area of inequity. So I think there's a pile of opportunity and just sort of navigating our way through a world that's never seen more extremities and inequalities mm-hmm. than we have today. The question then is, I mean, I think there's so much potential for this within, you know, papers and research papers or classes that we're looking at, but can we take it beyond the classroom? Could policy, foreign development policy, or South-South cooperation, or direct foreign direct investment, could it factor love into the design of its policy structures?
Right. I would argue that policy at all levels not only can, but needs to factor in love as a serious consideration. Before I explain how and why, I'll just flag that, you know, that idea may seem crazy, but there are a number of governments around the world that now very seriously take the idea of happiness
yeah.
as a goal of policy.
Bhutan is one.
Bhutan, the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
There are municipal governments all around the world track happiness.
New Zealand now has a well-being index.
Right. So, you know, love is maybe not so different. Its impacts on humans are different from happiness, qualitatively different from happiness. But it's not necessarily such a crazy idea. If we can take happiness as a goal for public policy, we should also be able to take love seriously. And here are some examples. First, I guess I'd say I'm a bit wary that any government or any public policy strategy could make people love better. But
right.
And I'd be a bit concerned about governments giving, you know, love lessons or courses in love. Although, interestingly, you know, a part of the public school curriculum in many provinces in Canada, part of the sex ed curriculum, is healthy relationships. So
yeah.
there's one
yeah,
example
yeah.
of the ways in which policy, it's not explicitly dealing with love, but it is explicitly dealing with healthy relationships.
Yeah, that's almost like your early interpersonal and,
right.
and self-awareness, right?
But if we get to the ways in which the ways in which governments can undermine people's ability to love and be loved,
yeah.
and then recognize that an important goal or kind of a check on public policy should be, does this policy or does this strategy undermine people's ability to love?
Yeah.
That's certainly something that governments can do. And let me give some examples. So one, we've already talked about the residential schools, about separating
yeah.
children from their parents. It would be easy to say, well, that's a historical example. It doesn't happen anymore. But still today, the number of Indigenous children who are separated from their parents and put into foster care
yeah.
With other families, the number continues to be very, very high. And it may be that we need to re-examine those policies in the context of the very strong evidence about the importance of love. So
yes.
the, you know, in some cases, the material quality of care may not meet the standards of government agencies,
yep.
but the emotional caring, the impact of love on those children, may be, in some cases, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, more important than the material conditions, or equally important. I'm
right.
not going to make policy suggestions at this point, but I think the importance of love needs to really be factored into those decisions. Another example, U.S. immigration detention centers on the southern border.
That was so brazen, so over the top, so visible, and yet it continued with impunity.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you think of, I mean, the medical evidence shows that when children are separated from their parents and don't feel love, that they will experience long-term physical and mental health impacts. So
Absolutely.
The costs of separating those children from their parents are not simply short-term trauma, but that experience for children of being separated from their parents can very easily have long-term mental and physical health implications. From a totally self-interested perspective of the American government, of state governments in the United States, if some of those children do eventually become U.S. citizens and are part of the U.S. economy and they're U.S. voters, the health costs will be costs to the United States.
That's right.
Some other examples, if we think of the countries around the world that have come to rely on immigration really as a development policy or as a development strategy, yeah. The Philippines comes to mind. The
thousands of nurses leaving every year.
Export of nurses and yep. home care workers really as a development strategy. This isn't accidental anymore. It's a state policy and strategy to export labor so that they'll send home remittances to their families. The long-term, and we don't know what the long-term impacts are, but we do know that many of those, in their large numbers, predominantly women, many of those women are living away from their families for very long periods of time.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they can't love and feel loved, but it certainly makes it a lot harder when you're thousands and thousands of kilometers away.
That's right. I mean, the you know, WhatsApp and FaceTime have helped, but it's certainly no replacement.
Many of us know the challenges of long-distance relationships,
yeah.
and especially over many years,
yes.
it's hard. Another example I'd like to flag is just the government policies around the essentially LGBTQ or I rights.
Yeah.
The number of countries around the world where it is illegal to be anything but
yep.
Straight. Mm-hmm. Again, that doesn't make love impossible, but it certainly complicates things. It can certainly make the public demonstration of love a physical safety danger. In some countries, you can be imprisoned, you could be killed, you could lose your job for expressing your love towards another person.
That's really, again, that comes back to our original point about how governments can just harm intentionally, you know, the very essence of human connections that are based around love.
Yeah. And for anyone, you know, anyone who's listening who might be skeptical to think, you know, this is just wishy-washy emotional stuff, I'd like to share some of the research on the medical benefits of love. And I'm just going to go through this quickly, just to flag.
And
some
you didn't
of the
take that Cuban medical course on love.
No,
this is independent research.
This was independent research, and what I found was that there's a lot of it in very well-respected medical journals and psychology journals on the positive health impacts of love. So, just let me share a few of these.
Please.
Again, medical and health research clearly links self-perceptions of being loved by others and loving others to health impacts such as a reduction of chronic pain, anxiety, and depression, improved functioning of the immune system, mm-hmm. increased life expectancy, lower risk of angina, ulcers, and cancer, as well as overall feelings of positive self-esteem, happiness, and general well-being. Beyond that, a study done in Canada using the Canadian National Population Health Survey between 1996 and 2000 found that self-perceptions of being loved had a greater positive impact on health outcomes than the negative impacts of daily smoking.
Whoa, say that again.
So love,
yeah.
the self-perception of uh-huh. being loved by other people
yeah.
has a greater impact on your health than the negative impact of smoking every day.
Oh my God.
And yet, you know, we wouldn't imagine doing research on health, or if a doctor was taking a case study,
yeah.
You know, not asking a question about, you know, do you smoke?
That's the first question they ask.
The research shows that love is actually more important, has a bigger impact on our health than smoking. Huh. And yet, even in the medical research,
yes.
doesn't take it that seriously.
Wow. So that's a big game changer to think about.
Yeah.
Impressive.
One of the really interesting, again, I'm a dilettante connecting fields of research. I'm not a medical researcher, but one of the things that I found really fascinating was why is love so powerful?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that love has really the self-perception
mm-hmm.
of being loved and of loving somebody else. So there's no objective measure of love. This is, do you feel loved, or do you feel that you are loving other people? That self-perception of love is responsible for reducing chronic stress and anxiety.
It makes so much sense.
And that's the link to human health. So
yes.
we know that chronic stress and anxiety basically reduces the cell life in our body.
Yep.
And love has a powerful impact on reducing that chronic stress and anxiety. So if you're feeling love, it's releasing all sorts of chemicals into your body that reduces chronic stress and anxiety. Yeah. And then love as an emotion itself can counterbalance the psychological impacts of negative emotions, things like anger, fear, hate.
It makes so much sense, because all of those emotions, when you're feeling them, if you're feeling under stress or duress, you are, your body is just, you know, thriving with cortisol, right?
Right.
Just going through, and to sort of calm that down and sort of get that in a better spot makes absolute sense to
me. I mean, so you've got the cortisol that's released by the negative emotions.
Yeah.
On the flip side, when you're feeling love and loving, that triggers the release of, and here's a long list, oxytocin, endorphins, endocannabinoids, endogenous morphine, dopamine, and vasopressin. All pretty powerful chemicals. These are natural chemicals in our body that are stimulated by the self-perception of being loved and loving.
This is good stuff. So as opposed to going to the pharmacy, if we just had more love.
A little bit more love.
It would come naturally. John Cameron, this has been a fascinating topic. Thank you very much for introducing the concept of love to the podcast. I knew it was going to be a good one when you came in here with flowers and chocolates. So I do appreciate that. And certainly we've got a lot more to cover on this area of research and the other ones that you're looking at as well. So I know we're running out of time. You've got to go to another event here, but we'd be delighted to have you back to chat some more.
Great. Well, thanks very much.